This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the two corporate parties, the Democrats and Republicans, monopolize electoral politics in the United States. But the Black is Back Coalition says there's still reason to pursue independent Black politics. And after 37 years behind bars, Mumia Abu-Jamal has won the right to another appeal and a possible new trial or freedom. But first, President Trump's trade war with China sometimes seems destined to escalate into a military confrontation. We spoke with Dr. Gerald Horn, the prolific author and professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Some in the Trump administration have expressed pleasure at reports that China's economy is slowing down, even though many economists believe that it was only a strong Chinese economy that kept the whole world from being plunged into a depression following the 2008 Wall Street meltdown. Dr. Horn says the U.S. is shooting itself in the foot with its China policy.
Well, it's quite striking, the report given just the other day by Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, who spoke like an economist and not the engineer that he is, when he suggested that one of the reasons why Apple's profit margins will probably be declining in coming months, if not coming years, is because of this trade war with China. That is to say that over recent decades, certain supply lines were developed in response to the entente between Beijing and Washington, and Apple is Exhibit A with regard to being heavily dependent upon production of its iPhones, in particular in China. And now with this new turn, this trade war, we see that U.S. corporations will be facing headwinds. And in fact, that was the message from Kevin Hassett, the White House economic advisor, that he reported on just the other day, telling U.S. corporations that they should be expecting that what's happening to Apple will be happening to them as well. And so we're talking about a lengthy list that includes particularly auto manufacturers such as General Motors and Ford, but also Starbucks, which opens cafes in China on an almost daily basis, not to mention Microsoft, and not to mention KFC, et cetera. And so the economic outlook for the United States and indeed its North Atlantic allies as well is not very promising. And then, in addition to the trade war, there is the jousting between the two navies in the South China Sea. There is the total impact on U.S. foreign policy generally. For example, I don't think you can separate the entente that Mr. Trump is trying to develop with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, as evidenced by the Singapore summit of mid-2018, from this Mayberry-Machiavelli idea that somehow the United States will be able to get an ally on the northeastern border of China, speaking of the DPRK, not to mention putting pressure on the DPRK's longtime, long-term antagonist, which is Japan, right across the Sea of Japan, and not to mention a neighboring South Korea. Similarly, it's interesting that when Mr. Trump announced recently that he would like to withdraw from Syria and Afghanistan, which of course caused a firestorm of protests to erupt from the neocons and the liberal hawks, the impetus apparently was this idea of clearing the deck so that there could be this clear-eyed focus on China. And what's even more striking is how this is a replay, that is to say, this U.S.-China impending Cold War. It's a replay, quite frankly, of what happened over a century ago. Recall that during the heyday of the British Empire, London was deathly frightened about Russia. that helps to shed light upon London's policy in so-called British India and Afghanistan, et cetera. All of this propaganda about the Russian movement towards warm water ports due south, and that led to this entente with Japan, quite frankly. Recall that when Japan defeated Russia in 1905, this was a venture that was largely financed and backed by London. And this, of course, was a major turning point, not only in the history of imperialism, but the history of white supremacy. But, of course, that backfired by December 8, 1941, when Japan moved to oust London from Singapore and Hong Kong and its other colonies in Asia. And, in fact, you cannot separate the decline and demise of the British Empire from that wrong-headed decision. And so, interestingly enough, it was over 45-odd years ago that Richard M. Nixon made what was called to be a stroke of genius when he worked out this entente with China, leading to massive foreign direct investment in China, and now creating what appears to be an unstoppable juggernaut that's impacting U.S. foreign policy all across the board, not only with regard to what we've already mentioned concerning Syria and Afghanistan and DPRK, but also Africa. Recall the speech that John Bolton, National Security Advisor, gave a few days ago, where he reversed the Trump campaign pledge on slashing foreign aid by talking about raising foreign aid to Africa, a direct response to China's role in Africa, the financing of the Museum of Black Civilization in Dakar, Senegal, the building of a massive world-class library at the University of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania and southeastern Africa, a direct outgrowth of Chinese largesse. Or even, if you think about it carefully, the fact that Disney invested so heavily in this movie Black Panther in some ways was a response to the fact that the largest cinema market today is in China, and one of China's box office winners in the prelude to the opening of Black Panther was Wolf Warrior 2, which takes place in an African, fictional African country, in many ways is more militantly anti-racist than Black Panther, and did better at the box office by some measures. And of course, Black Panther made over $1 billion. So this rise of China is one of the most important events of this year, and indeed of this century. And what's ironic is that U.S. imperialism did not learn the lessons of British imperialism. That is to say, this maniacal, obsessive focus on Moscow leading to disaster. And speaking of Moscow, I think one of the more intriguing developments of 2018 was this March 1st, 2018 speech given by President Putin, which your listeners can easily, or readers can easily find online, where he unveiled this new hypersonic missile, which can evade the most sophisticated anti-missile defense, including that which guards the United States of America. So in some ways, what's happened is that these alleged geniuses who direct U.S. foreign policy from the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the State Department in Washington have violated the basic edict of former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger when he suggested that the United States, by all means and measures, should try to disrupt the alliance between Moscow and Washington, have better relations with both parties than they have with each other. And yet at the same time, we see President Xi and President Putin meeting on a regular basis in 2018, which will continue in 2019, which suggests that the world is going through a major tectonic shift.
In terms of the U.S. move backfiring, it's unclear what effects the U.S. actions are having in the short and long term on the Chinese economy. But if it was successful in significantly slowing China's growth, that could devastate the world economy as a whole, including the U.S. How does that help America in the world?
Well, for some time now, there are those of us who have been arguing that the ultimate suicide bomber rests in Washington, D.C. That is to say that Washington is tempting fate and actually threatening to bring down the entire temple of the global economy if it is not allowed to dominate and predominate. Recall that is an outgrowth, if you think about it closely and carefully, of what happened from 1989 to 1991, where in some ways Washington threatened to blow up the Soviet Union and blow up the socialist camp and thereby blow up the world unless the socialist camp moved away from a state-directed economy. Now that same demand is being laid at the doorstep of the People's Republic of China. The fly in the ointment, however, as already noted, is that as a result of the Nixon venture to Beijing some 45 odd years ago, U.S. corporations have major investments in China, and that may serve to restrain U.S. imperialism somewhat. But thus far, that does not appear to be the case, which means that you probably should expect a severe recession in 2019, perhaps a return to the recessionary times of 2007-2008, where, as you know, black wealth in particular plummeted precipitously. And this is what is on offer as a result of the ham-fisted policies that are being executed from the White House.
Regarding the Bolton speech on Africa, it seems to be mostly full of hot air. The Trump administration has, for the last 2 years, been very much opposed to U.S. foreign aid to almost anybody. And in terms of the United States replacing China's role in infrastructure development in Africa, the United States can't even develop its own infrastructure. Can't even build one high-speed rail line.
Well, it's interesting. Over 3 decades ago, then U.S. President George H.W. Bush announced to the world the United States had more will than wallet. This was in a response to the cries that since Washington had done all that it could to bring down the socialist camp and thereby helping to wreck development plans, not only in Eastern Europe, but throughout the world, because so many nations, particularly independent African nations like Angola, were heavily dependent upon aid from the socialist camp. But he said the United States had more will than wallet, so you should be going elsewhere for aid. And interestingly enough, here you have a president, Mr. Trump, who referred to the entire African continent with a very dismissive barnyard epithet. And since this is a family audience I'm speaking to, I won't repeat it here. But suffice it to say, it was not very pretty and, in fact, was rather ugly. And not only that, but then dispatched his spouse. He was trying to escape, apparently, domestic tensions at home on this trip to Africa, where she basically used this continent as a backdrop for modeling different outfits, including a kind of colonial wear of the sort that you last saw in the Meryl Streep film Out of Africa. So this attempt by Mr. Bolton to try to reverse course and say that contrary to campaign rhetoric, the United States was going to try to compete with China and Africa with so much piffle. But it's not only that, and I think even our audience seems to be, at least some of it seems to be unduly focused on China and Africa. I would urge our audience to also look at other players in Africa. I mean, for example, when the all-important Eritrea-Ethiopia peace agreement was announced in 2018, this took place in Saudi Arabia. And that was not an accident because the Saudis are getting heavily involved and more involved, I should say, in that part of Africa, not only in terms of helping to broker that peace deal, but pay attention to those recent press reports that suggest that the Saudis are recruiting even child soldiers in Darfur, in the Sudan, and bringing them to Yemen, where they become so much cannon fodder. Keep in mind as well that their partner in that disastrous venture in Yemen, I'm speaking of the UAE, United Arab Emirates, has been accused of acting similarly. And we all know that in terms of religious zealotry, which has bedeviled Africa, particularly Eastern Africa, particularly Somalia, for some years now,
in some ways, that's being funded through the UAE and the Saudis. And hopefully on a more positive note, but it's alongside the same theme of other players in Africa. Note that in terms of Somalia, one of the most important players, and I would like to think in terms of the reconstruction of Somalia, has been Turkey. President Erdogan has been a regular visitor, believe it or not, to Mogadishu. And once again, I would like to urge our audience to not be so fixated on this Chinese role in Africa, and also to look at the traditional exploiters, such as France, whose pretensions to be a great power is heavily dependent upon its historic role as an exploiter of the African continent. There's going to be enormous pressure on France in light of this opening of the already aforementioned Museum of Black Civilization in Senegal, because Senegal is going to be pressuring France to return all that loot that Paris seized improperly and illicitly and illegally from Western Africa over the decades. You will see a similar cry emerge from other African nations. This will put enormous pressure on France to disgorge itself of such wealth. And this is taking place in the context of President Macron already being under severe pressure as a result of these yellow vest protests, which do not seem to be ceasing anytime soon.
And we should mention also that India plays a large economic role in Africa. And India, as well as the other BRICS country, Brazil, are both under the leadership of very right-wing regimes. What does that say about the political coherence of the BRICS? Brazil, South Africa, India, China, and Russia, which are governed by very different kinds of leaders.
I think it's fair to say that sooner rather than later, and certainly as long as Jair Bolsonaro, the recently inaugurated president of Brazil, is in office, that the BRICS will transmute into the RICS. That is to say, it would not be wise for Russia, India, China, and South Africa to be meeting in the same room with Mr. Bolsonaro, who is fundamentally an agent of Yankee imperialism, a man who has been characterized correctly as racist, sexist, homophobic, a man who, even before he took office, sought to insult the Cuban doctors, thousands of whom have provided yeoman service and duty to precincts in Brazil that many doctors in Brazil will not visit. And they, of course, began to pack up. And interestingly enough, despite the fact that China is the major trading partner of Brazil, Mr. Bolsonaro has indicated that he will also follow the Yankee line with regard to China. The only good news there is that it'll probably contribute to a crisis that may drive him from office prematurely. But before that happens, obviously, he's going to be wreaking a lot of havoc, not least in collaborating with Yankee imperialism in terms of further destabilization of Venezuela, not to mention seeking to destabilize Cuba, perhaps even reaching into Mexico, where the recent election of AMLO, López Obrador, has been a breath of fresh air in this hemisphere. And certainly we can expect and hope that Mexico will continue to extend its hospitality, which it has done, even under the previous bankrupt regime of Nieto, that is to say, extend hospitality to the thousands of Haitians who have gathered in Baja California, just south of San Diego, fleeing a dislocation in their homeland. Now, that's Brazil. Now, with regard to India, let us hope that Mr. Modi is going to face very stiff headwinds in 2019. Certainly, if you look at what's happened in Kerala, in southern India, a state where the left rules, let's say in Kerala itself, where in response to Hindu chauvinism, you had a remarkable demonstration of about 5 million women in Kerala linking hands to form a human chain in opposition to so-called Hindu chauvinism that Prime Minister Modi represents and embodies. And so India, of course, is a separate case, even though it does not have positive relations, to put it mildly, with China. Mr. Modi has not made the kind of inflammatory statements about China that have been coming from the lips of Mr. Bolsonaro. At the same time, Mr. Modi has continued the post-independence, post-1947 line out of New Delhi of having Moscow as a major interlocutor. I think that will continue. That's part of the political DNA of India, even if you have a Hindu chauvinist like Mr. Modi in office. But in any case, we should need to watch India very carefully, because certainly Washington feels that India will be part of what they now call the, quote, Indo-Pacific. That is to say, this part of this harebrained encirclement policy of China, which also includes Japan and also includes Australia, not to mention Yankee imperialism. But I dare say that the progressive forces in India, as represented by the aforementioned demonstration in Kerala in South India, where, by the way, the Communist Party rules in Kerala, that will be a kind of restraining factor on any kind of hot-headed, similarly harebrained schemes that Mr. Modi and his circle might seek to execute.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn speaking from Houston, Texas. The Democrats are flexing their congressional muscle, having taken over leadership of the U.S. House this month. But the Democratic Party seems divided into three factions. One faction believes all they have to do to become a majority party is to run against Donald Trump. Another faction looks forward to collaborating with Trump as much as possible. And the third, more progressive faction, believes the only way to win is by putting forward the kind of big programs like Medicare for All that large majorities of the public supports. Omali Yeshitela is no Democrat. He's chairman of the Black Is Back Coalition, which will hold another in its series of electoral political schools in St. Louis in April.
Well, one thing I think is really important is to recognize that the whole bourgeois setup is being threatened, and that's something that has caused a serious kind of fracturing. It's growing every day. That's part of the crisis of imperialism, of the unity of the bourgeoisie. I mean, when you had in the last election 17 different people contending for the Republican nomination for president, and some more than five of the Democrat, I think there's 17 or 18 people lined up already. They were moving toward, from the Democratic Party side, wanting to contend for the presidency. And then looking at the different categories that you just mentioned, the three, those who want to run against Trump, those who want to cooperate with Trump, collaborate with Trump, and those who are talking about offering up a new kind of a political trajectory, narrative, what have you. And then there's the struggles that's happening even between them, between, you know, the Bernie Sanders and the others, the Biden-Clinton contention. The entire process is being riven. And that's because the point that the people who are engaged in this process cannot grapple with in a very serious way, and that is the whole damn social system. The entire bourgeois apparatus is under assault now by events in history and by people who are trying to solve their real problems in the real world. So it is interesting to look at, and I think that they made the same mistake in 2016 with Trump, and did not understand the question then. And Hillary Clinton had done all the right things. Bush had done all the right things in terms of positioning themselves to simply step in, one or the other, to achieve the leadership of the U.S. imperialist state. And it didn't work that way. The people are someplace different. And the reason the people are someplace different is because the entire bourgeois electoral process, the entire system, is something that is held in high disregard by all kinds of peoples. And that's why you see the disappearance, in some estimation, of the so-called center, the moderate political stances. Moderates are in big-time trouble. So you saw the Trump populism on the one hand, the Sanders populism on the other hand, and then the Clinton, I guess, and Bush moderation didn't stand a chance because the people want something other than what the system appears to offer them. And then they got from Trump and from Sanders something that appeared to be different from what the system was all about. And then, of course, you have the hustlers and opportunists who expect to get a payday, a payoff, either way it goes. They just simply stick their finger up in the air and see which way the wind is blowing and try to go in those directions. That's part of what it is that we're looking at, but I think the system is troubled and it is incapable of analyzing itself. And therefore, what it does, you have the situation where one sector of the ruling class or different sectors are analyzing each other, trying to find their position. And it's akin to that old saying about moving the chairs around on the deck of the Titanic. And the whole damn thing is sinking, or it could sink. I'm not saying it is sinking. Let me retreat from that position because their weakness and their confusion and their contradictions do not necessarily automatically translate into strength and power for the people. But it does represent a serious contradiction. We are looking at a serious contradiction within the whole social system, and it is being reflected in what you're looking at in terms of what's being positioned and offered up as a solution to the Trump administration or to where we are politically in this country right now.
The Black is Back Coalition's having a national conference in April that revolves around electoral politics. What kind of clarity do you expect to come out of that conference in terms of Black folks and people on the left and what to do about this confusing system?
You know, it's increasingly difficult to tell what the hell is the left or a left or but what is sure, and the thing that I am really appreciative of, is what the Black is Back Coalition has done, is in the process of doing, has been doing for a number of years now, and that I believe really has been punctuated by the work we've begun dealing with the electoral process. As you know, when Chokwe Lumumba ran for mayor, we endorsed, contributed to that. When Comrade Ron Gutierrez from the Mexican National Liberation Movement ran for office as city council in Los Angeles, California, we supported, endorsed, and supported that. And there have been other candidates that the coalition supported. But for the first time, 3 years ago, we initiated a process where we said we're going to intervene differently. We started a process first where we wanted to help our people come to terms with a different understanding of what we should be fighting for. The one thing that's been difficult for a population that experienced the defeat of a revolution and the dispersal of the members of the most militant revolutionary organizations, the destruction of those organizations, is people are scattered and there's a lot of confusion within the general political body of our communities in terms of what the hell are we fighting for, so that in many instances it has been limited to supporting this Democrat or that Democrat or simply the electoral process without any kind of understanding within our community or discussion, even among the most serious forces who are trying to fight for some kind of transformation. And what the coalition has done is offer up, as you've often said, like a definition to give some meat of what does self-determination mean? What does it look like? First of all, we're saying that self-determination has to be what we're fighting for, that it is the highest expression of democracy for Black people to be self-determining. But what does self-determination mean concretely? How can that be articulated? How can it be fought for in our communities? And so the remarkable thing that we've done, and I'm not sure how many people appreciate that, is that we worked on developing a national political agenda for self-determination for Black people. And it wasn't just something that, you know, the members of the coalition or the steering committee of the coalition just did by ourselves. We took it on the road and we held something like 10 state conventions for African people to have this discussion of a national Black political agenda for self-determination and laid out concretely what self-determination can look like, should look like, when it's been fought for in this country. And this is what we say that African people should be looking at. And then we had a national convention in Washington, D.C. And then subsequent to that, we organized the black electoral schools where we're challenging this whole notion of this elite group of black people from our community, if you will, being the only ones who can participate in the electoral process, which means that usually they've been tied to the Democratic Party or even to their own self-defined work to help the black community without any meaningful participation or feedback from the African community itself, that the people didn't have any way to participate in this process. And, of course, this is happening within the context of a defeated revolutionary movement from the 1960s, so that many people have been convinced that the only way you can do things is through the electoral process, that somehow the electoral process has almost been deified. So the coalition was determined to take that on, and not only to take it on, but to draw ordinary African people, people who are activists in many instances, people who are just tired and fed up in their communities. You can run for office, too. And not only can you run for office, because it's been mystified by a lot of people, you know, only the smart people, the educated, the most proper African people can participate in this process, or you got to be a part of the Democratic Party or something else like that. And so we're opening up this whole process to the African community. And that's really important, because what happened to us is that we had a magnificent revolutionary movement of the 1960s that the U.S. government killed. The CIA, FBI, all kinds of intelligence organizations attacked it, assassinated leaders, destroyed a revolutionary movement even as they were moving toward this whole process of universal suffrage. So that happened with the Civil Rights Act of 1965, but this is the same time they're killing off the revolution. They're killing off the black agenda for self-determination that was being put forth by different black organizations in this country. And so now you can only participate in the electoral process through the Democratic Party, which has never been a revolutionary organization. And they destroyed our organization, destroyed our program, gave us the Democratic Party and the Democratic Party program. And that's what's been leading up to now, until the coalition intervened in this process and brought the people right smack back. We are doing that, bringing the people right back into the process and saying, this is the program. This is the program that we were fighting for in the 1960s, more or less, that has been modified to meet the requirements of this era, this time that we're living in, and the people can intervene in the electoral process. We can teach you how. There's no mystery here. There's no religious basis for voting or not voting. It's the interest of the people, and here's how our interests are reflected in actual program, and that's what the National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination was about, and that's what we've done. And we have two schools up to now. We have another school that's coming up in April of this year for the purpose of helping to bring more and more African people into this process and to fight in this process on our own terms and to demand anybody else who claims to be representing African people speak from our National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination. And that's where we've been. And some people have been soft on it, even in the coalition, but we've pushed it. And I think that we've seen in Missouri, we had at least one person. In Florida, we had at least two persons who ran for political office on the National Black Political Agenda. And perhaps we've done it in other places. And coming into April at this school, coming into this election season, we've got at least four people who are influenced by or participate directly with the coalition who will be running for political office on the National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination. So that's an important kind of intervention that we are making, and it will reverberate throughout this process in a moment, and you can see the significance of what we're doing by how the bourgeoisie, how the ruling class is moving right now, how it is moving the Democratic Party to recruit more young African women in particular and African people into this process, how I read a couple of weeks ago about how the rich donors now from the Democratic Party are trying to put their money with the so-called leftists in the Democratic Party, anything to maintain the political motion and activity of the people within the safe embrace of the Democratic Party, and from their perspective, the safe embrace of the electoral process, and the coalition is challenging that. And the significance of what we're doing, again, is reflected in the fact that the bourgeoisie is trying to do similar things from its position and based on its interests.
Yes, every project for self-determination, for community control of the police, for black community control of schools yeah. always runs right into the brick wall of the Democratic Party. And yeah. we have an election year coming up, a presidential election year. And the black misleadership class in the Democratic Party will be wanting black folks to be looking at Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and others such as them.
Yes. And, of course, the thing is about the African petty bourgeoisie, it has no loyalty to anybody except itself. And if you remember, even with the thing with Barack Hussein Obama, which was an abomination, even with him, if you remember, initially many of those Africans who were in office, the Democratic Party darlings, they refused to support Obama. They were going with Hillary Clinton because they thought that's the side that their bread was buttered on. They had no interest in Obama because he was black or because he represented black people. They were interested in their own self, their own careers, and their uncles and people like that. And so it was only after Obama was convincingly successful and had picked up obvious support from masses of African people that many of these black people who were attached to the Democratic Party in office and things like that, they became Obamaites. So yeah, we've got these forces, and they will pick their own who they think we should be fighting for and supporting, and none of them has ever done a damn thing to speak out in the interest or legislate in the interest or even articulate something that smells of a program in the interest of the African people, and especially African poor and working people, and none of them has done anything meaningful to try and stop any assault on black people. They might have assault to stop to, and when I say assault, I'm talking about on basic kinds of programs that black people fought for and died for in this country that are now under assault, under the, and one of the obvious pretexts they are using to be able to attack Social Security, to be able to attack welfare, to be able to attack the so-called social safety network is this budget deficit that Trump ratcheted it up mightily with giving away this big tax break to the ruling class. And so you don't see them making a fight in the interest of black people in opposition to any of that. You don't see them even standing up to the brutal butchery that the United States government is employing against people in Yemen. And I don't want to say anything about Saudi Arabia doing this. Saudi Arabia doesn't do anything. It's the United States government that operates their military, operates their planes, that fixes their planes, that gives them the, that sits right next to the Saudis as they're deploying weapons of grievous terror. And you don't see them standing up for that. You don't see them standing up for anything righteous. They stand up for their own self-interest and require black people to support them simply because they're black. Those days are over.
Yes, the vast majority of the Congressional Black Caucus went along with the huge Trump military budget, and 80% of the Black Caucus went along with Pentagon funding and arming of local police departments, and 75% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to make police a protected class.
You know, part of what this is about, too, I want people look at this whole question about the U.S. government selling so-called surplus weapons to police organizations around this country. That's BS. There's no surplus weapons they're selling. They're violating even their own constitutional prohibition against having, like, state police and against the military participating in actions against the people inside this country. Because what we're really looking at is part of the Pentagon budget. It's the Pentagon budget. It's the Pentagon deployment of all kinds of forces in our own community that they are called police and things like that. I mean, if you have a situation in Dallas, Texas, where an African stands up and attacks the occupying military force in the form of the police, and the police there really exposed as being cowardly and inept, all they have to do is go to their office and pick up some C4, military C4, and put it on a robot and send the robot to kill the person. We wouldn't have known that was there until this thing happened. We wouldn't have known they had that C4. We knew they used C4 back in the 1980s when they dropped it on the MOVE organization in Philadelphia and what have you. But my point is that what they're calling this so-called surplus weapons that they're selling to the police is not surplus. It's a part of the budget. It's budgeted in. You don't have a surplus forever. You don't just keep having a surplus every year. It's a part of the budget. And you're right, the Congressional Black Caucus has never opposed that. In fact, had an opportunity to vote against some of this, and in every instance, they have supported the use of these domestic military forces that they call the police against us. And that's what we are up against in the real world, and that's why what the coalition is doing is so important, because it is, while the U.S. government is supplying police organizations throughout this country and others throughout the world with bombs and the missiles and things like that to kill and destroy people, the coalition is arming our community with information, with analysis, with an element of organization that will allow the community to intervene in political life in a way that we're not supposed to be able to do since they crushed our movement in the 1960s. And it is a new era. And just like in the 1960s, when it was necessary for our organizations and our community to go up against these sellouts, this African petty bourgeois neo-colonial sector of our community, just like it was necessary to do that in the 1960s, we're going to see that increasingly the community is capable of doing that in the 2019 and the 2000s. And I just want to say that this is such a crucial development that I think the coalition has brought onto the scene, where now the African petty bourgeoisie lickspittles do not have a monopoly on the electoral process. We are destroying their monopoly so that they can't just sit and claim that they're speaking for us without some kind of contention, that we can contend with them even within the electoral arena. So when they open their mouths, there will be somebody who represents the people really standing up there presenting the National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination that will attempt to defend our community and make it necessary for these sellouts to fight against.
That was Omali Yeshetela, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition, speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida. Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal are ecstatic over a Philadelphia judge's decision that could allow the nation's best-known political prisoner another chance to appeal his conviction in the death of a police officer 37 years ago. We asked Professor Johanna Fernandez of the Campaign to Bring Mumia Home if there's finally a real pathway to freedom for Abu-Jamal.
We do indeed, and this is, again, unprecedented because the courts, year after year, have refused to hear arguments on the unconstitutionality and violations of conduct by the prosecutor, the judge, and the police in the original conviction trial of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And now, for the first time, a judge in Philadelphia, in the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas, has said that there, in fact, was bias, judicial bias, in the review of a series of appellate hearings that Mumia requested in the 1990s. So this is really groundbreaking opening in this case that I think, if we win, will strike a blow to white supremacy in this country, because Mumia's case has been heralded by the Fraternal Order of Police and by politicians as the major law and order case of this contemporary moment in American history. And they've used the case to essentially galvanize and strengthen the criminal justice system.
Now, what the Superior Court Judge Leon Tucker ruled was that there was an appearance of bias because the former prosecutor, Ronald Castile, who went on to become a Supreme Court judge, then was allowed to sit in on the deliberations over Mumia's previous appeals. Now, Castile won't be allowed to sit in on any future appeals, but you're going up against the same Supreme Court without him. Why are the prospects better?
Well, I think the prospects are better for the same reason that this law and order judge, Leon Tucker, ruled in favor of Mumia. This is a different moment in American history. Ironically, we have an arsonist in the White House, but a series of movements have in fact shifted consciousness on the ground and exposed the criminality, if you will, of the criminal justice system. So we have to thank the movement that organized around the execution of Troy Davis. I want to remind you that this is really the moment when this shift began. There was an international movement to stop the execution of Troy Davis that lost. But that name was imprinted in the minds of people of conscience in this country. That was followed by the Occupy Wall Street movement, which essentially made it okay for the first time in American history to criticize capitalism. And then there were a series of police shootings of Black people in this country that led to the Black Lives Matter movement. And that combined with the publication of Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow means that people in the mainstream today acknowledge that there is a grave problem with police brutality and mass incarceration. At the same time, we have a situation in which even conservative judges across the country understand that if we don't hold the line to essentially legitimize the criminal justice system at a time when Trump is in the White House, all legitimacy of the system will be lost. So even conservative judges are ruling in ways that they had not previously. So this is the context within which this new opportunity is presented to us. And what we need to make sure is that we continue to shift consciousness on the issues and the violations surrounding the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And we need to once again make the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal a household discussion.
Yes, I remember in the 1980s, the Philadelphia chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, of which Mumia was a founding member, didn't want to have anything to do with him as a defendant. And yet now the NAACP is part of his defense, and Mumia's plight has become, in a sense, somewhat mainstreamed.
Right. So part of what happened in an earlier epoch, I say epoch because this case has been litigated in the court system for 37 years. So we've seen generations come and go. And at the height of the movement, Mumia was a villain in the public eye. The Fraternal Order of Police demonized him. He was the poster child of the Fraternal Order of Police, and he symbolized the reason for them, for the Fraternal Order of Police and their supporters, the reasons why the apparatus of incarceration needed to be cranked up. I don't know if you remember, but in the 1990s, Mumia was named in a mainstream newspaper a super predator by a criminologist, a well-known criminologist. He literally began an article, I think in the New York Times, identifying Mumia and the likes of Mumia as a super predator who essentially was a threat to security in the United States. But that was in the 1990s, ironically, at the height of the movement that stopped Mumia's execution. But unfortunately, the policies of the Clintons reigned supreme during that period, and the apparatus of incarceration was cranked up. But again, this is a new period, and the fact that a very mainstream organization is defending Mumia Abu-Jamal, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, these are the folks who argued Brown versus Board of Education, suggests that a new day has dawned and Mumia I believe, is coming home.
If the courts do entertain Mumia's appeal, what kind of issues will be reopened, issues that people may have forgotten with time?
Well, one of the major issues that will be presented to the appellate court is that a court stenographer by the name of Terry Moore Carter overheard the judge who presided over the original case, Albert Sabo, say to another judge in the anteroom of the court, quote, "I'm going to help them fry the nigger," unquote, referring to how the judge was going to instruct the jury. Other issues include prosecutorial misconduct. So part of what happened during the trial was that the prosecutor suppressed exculpatory evidence, essentially that there was a fourth person at the crime scene. Another issue is that there was tampering with evidence on the part of the police. And I will remind your listening audience that a third of the police officers involved in Mumia's case who collected evidence within weeks of the end of Mumia's trial were convicted and jailed for corruption and tampering with evidence to obtain convictions. And this was part of a larger investigation conducted by the Department of Justice in 1979, in which the Department of Justice determined that the behavior of the police department in Philadelphia was homicidal. And I'm quoting that report and quote what they said about the dealings of the police department in Philadelphia was that, quote, "it shocks the conscience." And so these are some of the issues that are going to be heard if the DA of Philadelphia, the progressive Larry Krasner, does not challenge the decision of Leon Tucker.
And what are the indications in terms of DA Krasner's intentions?
Maureen Faulkner, the widow of Daniel Faulkner, the police officer that Mumia is wrongfully accused of killing, was on Fox News just this weekend, essentially saying that Mumia killed her husband and she would not stop until she secures justice in this case. And she said to Fox and Friends that her people would be hearing from the DA of Philadelphia, Larry Krasner, in the next, quote, couple of days. So there is a tremendous amount of pressure placed on Larry Krasner right now by the Fraternal Order of Police. But Krasner was not elected by the Fraternal Order of Police. He was elected by the people of Philadelphia, who campaigned hard for him. And he was a candidate outside of the Democratic Party apparatus who won. This is unprecedented in the history of Philadelphia. There has been no DA in Philadelphia, either in the Democratic or Republican Party, who's been elected without the support of the Fraternal Order of Police. Larry Krasner won because the people of Philadelphia mobilized for his campaign and voted en masse. And they voted because he promised to correct the wrongs of his predecessors. And he essentially said that the prosecution's office should not be preoccupied with prosecution, but rather with justice. So we know that Larry Krasner is nationally renowned and celebrated for reforms at the local level. He has decriminalized marijuana. He has address the issue of police corruption and tampering with evidence. He is single-handedly responsible for freeing the hip-hop artist Meek Mill, and he even wrote a letter in support of Debbie Africa, one of the members of the Move 9 who was recently released. So the question we pose to Larry Krasner is if he's going to heed the call of Leon Tucker, who, by the way, is a Law and Order judge. And what he says in the decision, and I'm reading from the decision right now, is that in order for the criminal justice system to work, quote, justice must be completely just, without even a hint of partiality, lack of integrity, or impropriety, unquote. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few weeks. In the meantime, if he appeals, this issue will wind its way through the lower courts and then the federal courts, and it will delay, for sure, Mumia's path to freedom.
In addition to demonstrations, the Mumia campaign has some other public agitation.
Absolutely. We'd like to inform your listening audience that on Saturday, January 12th, we're having a legal report back at the People's Forum titled Special Report, New and Favorable Legal Developments in the Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And once again, that is happening on Saturday, January 12th at 3 p.m. at the People's Forum, which is at 320 West 37th Street in New York City.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.